The people we live with can have a dramatic effect on our well-being. For many, a roommate is a quintessential part of the college experience, but people live together long after they get their diplomas, and the struggle to coexist with strangers can persist from summer camp to the retirement home. In a book called The Roommates, Stephanie Wu, an associate editor of Town & Country, gives us 70 tales of cohabitation in 20th century households, from horror stories to happy endings, passive-aggressive post-its to stolen groceries. It's published by Picador, and she joins us now, along with two of her contributors, who prefer to remain anonymous, so we'll call them Grace and Malia, and I am very pleased to welcome them all to our show. Hello.
Hi.
We also invite our listeners to share their roommate stories. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692 or write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. Or you can tweet us your pithy roommate story. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Stephanie, you say that you've had about 20 roommates over the years. That's a lot of roommates.
Yes, it is.
Did you have good luck most of the time?
I did. And I had, you know, never thought much about what it was, you know, good or bad roommates, really, until I started doing the interviews for the book, and then I truly realized, wow, I got it good.
But some of them were strange. One of your roommates would step inside a wardrobe and close the doors?
Yes, and that happened during summer camp. And I have to admit, you know, while writing the book, I went back and counted my roommates, summer camp, college, study abroad, post-grad, and I had to dig deep to remember this crazy roommate tale. I think I'd blocked it in my memory a bit, and it was something I had to actively recall.
And that was a way of gaining privacy?
That was privacy, yes, but also I think teenage insecurity. You know, when you're 12 and you're living with a stranger and, you know, as many teenage girls are, not very happy with their bodies, she decided that for the privacy and for the security, she preferred to step into a wardrobe, close the doors behind her, very tiny space.
Even though you were a girl as well.
Yes.
In the course of this book, we meet hamster lovers, rent stiffers, pancake makers. Are roommates generally remembered mostly for their idiosyncrasies, Malia?
Yes. If they had some redeeming factors, they were kind of swept under the rug. I try to be fair in my memories of my roommates, but it's the stories that stay with you.
You think that's true, Grace?
Oh, absolutely. And I also think it's very easy to remember people's reactions to you and to not necessarily realize what you're doing.
Right.
Perhaps to
it's one-sided to an extent.
Yeah, because you're as much a part of the equation as the other person.
Of course.
And there are people who could write roommate stories about you.
Absolutely. Well, some of my interviewees even did say, you know, I played a part in this and I shouldn't have let it go so far. I probably could have nipped the passive aggressiveness in the bud, but at the time, I was a kid.
But good roommates don't make an interesting story, so most of these stories are horror stories.
That's correct. That being said, good roommates can be memorable, too. There are roommates in my book who started a relationship, and, you know, I'm hoping they live happily ever after. There are roommates who've started businesses together. That's certainly a story worth telling, and it can really go either way.
We've already received a tweet from a woman calling herself Vicky, who relates her cohabitation horror story. She writes, "She blotted lipstick on wall, used my toothbrush to put her hair up, then married my old beau."
Wow.
Who's the old beau?
Yes, there are definitely stories in the book of roommates sleeping with other roommates' paramours. So, you know, you share a lot as a roommate. I never thought it would go that far, but it's a possibility.
In New York City, the number of people residing in non-family households increased more than 40% from 2000 to 2010. Is it due solely to rising rents? Is this a matter of economic necessity?
I think rent is a huge factor, but of course, you know, many people, myself included, just don't feel ready to live alone, especially in such a big city, especially if they're new to New York. And also, you know, rising age of marriage, of course. If you're not ready to move in with someone serious, start a relationship, get married, then many people opt to live with friends for as long as they can.
Do college students and 20-somethings make up most of the percentage?
They do. That being said, there are also, that number includes relatives who are not direct nuclear families, so not parents, not siblings.
You divide the book into six different sections. Was it determined by generations, college years, post-grad, et cetera?
You know, I toyed with how to divide the book. I thought perhaps the good, bad, and ugly, but I didn't want to spoil the chapters before you started reading them, and chronologically felt the best way, and also it shows, you know, this is a ritual that you can experience in many stages of growing up.
Grace, you mentioned that the roommate problem can be on both sides. So how much of this is really just a mismatch of personalities? It could be one person is an early riser, the other one likes to party late at night, and neither of them are bad people.
I think it can definitely be a function of time and place in people's lives and when they do come together. And in more than the when, it's the why. And like you touched on, people might have certain reasons for moving in with a roommate, whether it's a new relocation or a desire for companionship or friendship, or a relationship's ended and someone is sort of on the roommate market again, so to speak. And I think it's important to outline expectations from a roommate and what someone can expect of you at the onset of roommate inception, because at that stage you can outline whether or not you want space in the morning and whether you are really particular about someone using something of yours, or if you bring home your favorite beer, like, don't touch it.
Even fiscally, I kind of wish I'd been more upfront in the beginning, just because sometimes one roommate will maybe provide a lot of furniture and then you don't discuss what that means later when you go to buy something, and he or she might feel like, oh, well, I don't need to buy anything because I provided this furniture, and maybe establishing some sort of ground rules. It's not that much fun, but in the long run, it makes sense.
Using all your pots and pans.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A listener, Kara, on Twitter sent us this story. A roommate at my last apartment had a party with a DJ at 6 a.m. on a Monday while I had the flu. And she used the hashtag Craigslist, so I have to assume that she didn't know her roommate very well. How, Stephanie, how many of the people you spoke to met their roommates through Craigslist?
A good amount, and many mentioned other services similar to Craigslist. There's one just for Jewish roommates. There's a version in the UK. There's a version in Canada. I never knew there were so many spawns of Craigslist.
It's like online dating.
Yes. But certainly a large amount of the stories came from the fact that my interviewees did not know their roommates or anything about them or have any mutual friends going in.
Well, with online dating, there are these logarithms that at least in theory would suggest that you have things in common with roommates. But in this case, it's really just the luck of the draw.
Absolutely. And there's a big difference between going on a first date and saying, yes, let's move in together.
My guests are Stephanie Wu, who's written a book called The Roommates, True Tales of Friendship, Rivalry, Romance, and Disturbingly Close Quarters. It's published by Picador. And two of the people whose stories appear in the book, we are calling them Grace and Malia because they prefer to remain anonymous. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Why do you prefer to remain anonymous, and why Malia?
Well, I'm a big fan of Barack Obama, of course, and I could have been Sasha, but I opted for Malia. So I'm telling my story. I've had almost, I did a count like Stephanie did, about 41 roommates and suitemates.
Wow.
I mean, I studied abroad and I lived with 8 girls at one time in one apartment with no living room, so that was a lot of fun. 2 bathrooms, hot water didn't run at the same time. But I started out, beginning of my roommate experience, I went to a 2-year boarding school for the arts, and I focused in creative writing. It's very intensive. And I had gone to a summer program before that, and I'd made a group of friends, and they were all going to the school, and they really encouraged me to go with them. And so I lived with them, one of them, and then they were my suite mates, and then eventually they made more friends. And so that was a big part of the reason why I went. And so you have these 3-hour classes every day, very intensively, workshops, and you're putting all of your feelings out because it's a writing class. And yeah, so we started out friends, and I'm not really sure what happened. I mean,
it became a mean girl experience.
It's a mean girl experience.
How old were they?
We were 16. I met them when I was 15, and we were 16. But now you have like your standard fare mean girls, but then you have art school mean girls, which I think is.
And why are they different? Are they more creative at being mean?
Yes, they're creatively mean because they. I mean. Especially as writers, they're analyzing your character and your flaws, and they really know how to get under your skin.
It'd be even worse to be with a bunch of psych majors.
Right. Oh, God. I'm really glad I didn't go to, well, the art school for psychology. That makes no sense. But, yeah, so it just kind of spiraled. So I was a very type A 16-year-old. I was in student council and yearbook staff, and I wore these blazers that I bought from, like, Ann Taylor Loft and The Limited and matching pearls, and I was just kind of an obnoxious human, but I meant well.
What were some of their most creative ways to express their hostility?
They would find a photo of me that they thought was unflattering, and they would change the backgrounds of the computers around the school to the face with, like, writing on it.
Wow.
They would...
That's a lot of work.
I know. It's very creative. They would take one shoe, but not the other shoe, and just hide it. They'd wear my clothes when I wasn't around, and they would post photos of themselves wearing my clothes to MySpace, because we were using MySpace. Or they would sneak onto my computer when I was in the shower and read my IMs and then send them to each other. And then when I came out of the shower, they'd accuse me of having talked behind their backs about them. They'd like, run their fingers through my makeup. And then in writing class, I would always feel this sense of, I was just worried that I was being judged for my writing, and just added this layer of discomfort. So
it's amazing that you survived. What about you, Grace? Well, first of all, where'd you come up with the name Grace?
It's a virtue that I admire and want to embody.
You lived in what you called the pseudo frat.
I did. I lived in two.
Well, didn't you think that you were just moving in with your boyfriend?
The first pseudo fraternity I moved into in New York was first out of necessity. I relocated to New York after meeting someone during a study abroad program in London, and we finished our programs, our senior years, separately at our respective schools. And to sort of buy myself time looking for an apartment when I moved to New York, I moved in with him and four of his friends, which made a grand total of six people in a three-bedroom apartment. I was sleeping on a top bunk, keeping my clothes in the oven, getting dressed in the morning, rushing off to an internship at a fashion magazine, which was complicated in and of itself, and all the while trying to build a life for myself and have a social life outside of these five men who were wonderful, but they were recently graduated liberal arts students who really had no interest beyond shirking all responsibility.
Were they still relating in the ways that college boys do?
Absolutely.
So this is like being in the fraternity, the post-grad fraternity.
Absolutely, but I was the only significant other, so I was sort of looked down upon.
Well, what do you think? Did it teach you something about the male sex in general?
Oh, of course. I don't even know where to begin, but number one, don't impose motherly instincts on men who are not your sons or boyfriends.
So you couldn't scold the Galactica boys for their messy housekeeping?
No. And in truth, I didn't really have the time, which probably made the experience more enjoyable.
In your experiences in general, how important was food as a source of contention? Because different people have different cooking habits. They have different dietary restrictions. Was that a problem for some of the people you wrote about?
Food comes to mind in one particular story of one roommate who was incredibly possessive of her belongings. She had brought a couch to the apartment but told her roommate that her guests couldn't sit on this couch because it was hers. And this possessiveness carried over to items in the refrigerator. So
they couldn't sit on the couch?
They couldn't sit on the couch, even though it was in the living room, which one would assume is a shared space. She was incredibly possessive of her milk, of her juice. And one day, the girl I interviewed, she had a guest come over who wanted to do something nice for them. She wanted to bake them cookies to thank, you know, her hosts. She'd used up the butter in the refrigerator, not knowing it was the roommate's butter. And when the roommate came home, she fished the butter wrapper out of a trash can, taped it to the refrigerator door with a sign, this is my butter, 3 exclamation marks. Yeah. And the girl I interviewed, you know, at that point didn't know what to do except apologize and say, I will buy you more butter.
You also spoke to somebody who was on Top Chef.
I did. I thought it was incredibly important to interview someone who had been on a reality show, because these are, you know, vehicles of entertainment built around the way people interact when living together. So, you know, I was open to just about any reality show, though many of them you see it on television. So Spike Mendelsohn, a former Top Chef and Next Iron Chef contestant who I interviewed, he talked about more of the behind the scenes that you don't really see on TV, less of the cooking competition, but what goes on when you get a bunch of grown, very successful men into a room who have lived their professional lives and now have to share bunk beds once again and then compete against each other in the morning. And it was a pretty fraught relationship, to say the least.
Because they had to try to figure out how to live together under normal circumstances at the same time that they were hoping that the other ones would fail.
Exactly. And while there's a sense of camaraderie among chefs, you know, you tend to want to make friends with each other. But the truth of the matter was it was a competition and it was survival of the fittest.
So what happened? Did they kill each other?
They did not. They're all still alive and well, although Spike did encourage a friend of his to compete on the show with him, not realizing that said friend was a major snorer, keeping him up all night despite the heavy production schedule. So in retrospect, he jokes he wished he hadn't encouraged that friend to sign up.
Did he talk about having a survival strategy?
I think the survival strategy was really just to find time for yourself, which I think is a universal thing that's true of any roommate story. You know, when your living space isn't necessarily 100% your own, I think it's very important to just find a space, whether it's a coffee shop, whether it, you know, even if it's your office, but to find some time for introspection so that you don't feel driven crazy by having people around you all the time.
My guests are Stephanie Wu, who's written a book called The Roommates, True Tales of Friendship, Rivalry, Romance, and Disturbingly Close Quarters. It is published by Picador in a paperback. And we also have with us two of the people who tells their stories in this book. They're calling themselves Grace and Malia. We invite you to join in the conversation. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692 or write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We'll be back with more right after this. And we are back with Stephanie Wu, associate editor of Town and Country, who has put together the tales of 70 different roommates, most of them terrible stories. Two of the people in the book who are calling themselves Grace and Malia are also here. And we are inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page, WNYC.org, or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And a number of people have asked on Twitter if it's Kara especially, is it better to live with strangers or friends? Is it better to live with relatives? What do you think, Grace?
I lived with, until recently, a cousin of mine who's my age, and we grew up together, born within just a few months of each other, and were then and are now incredibly close, very much like siblings, but that also led to a lot of sibling rivalry and pent-up sibling emotion when we were living together, and we had the added complication of our third roommate being his very dear friend from college, who I'd never met until we all convened in this apartment in Williamsburg in Brooklyn. And while I absolutely recommend living with family, it's an incredible comfort, and especially living far away. I'm from the Midwest, and so is he. It's ripe for passive aggression if people aren't upfront.
They say you really don't know someone until you live with them.
That is absolutely true. Yeah.
So even though you knew your cousin, you didn't really
know
your cousin.
Yeah, I think having the experiences, I mean, having so many roommates, you end up learning a lot about yourself and what you can live with and what you can't live with. So I have had some good friends who've wanted to live with me, and I've had to say nicely, I love you, and I think our friendship would be much better off if we were not sharing mm-hmm. the same living space. So I think it's like it's almost like you want a friend that you don't know very well, so kind of an acquaintance or a friend of a friend who can be recommended, but you don't have the same exact friend group, so that you're not fighting and there's no jealousy. If you don't work together, that's probably for the best, too.
In stories like The Amateur Taxidermist or The Goldfish Killer, in this book, it seems like societal rules of decorum and respect break down. What makes roommate diplomacy turn so sour?
You know, again, I think it's not having a clear idea of what the roommate relationship will be, and sometimes you can't help it, especially when you're going to college, for instance, and it's freshman year and you've got a randomly placed roommate, such was the case with the amateur taxidermist, where the girl that I interviewed had her roommate tell her, "I just want you to let you know I'm keeping our dead hamster in the freezer. I'm interested in practicing taxidermy, and I'd like to do so on this hamster and then hang it from a hot air balloon."
Wait, what?
And when my interviewee, you know, expressed shock at this, you know, statement, the roommate's response was, "I just want you to respect the hamster. You know, would you respect your uncle if he died?" Completely non sequitur, but that's what went down, and I think that is a perfect example of mismatched personalities and not really knowing what you're getting into.
So what happens in those cases? Do people just say, "I better find another place as quickly as possible"?
Well, my interviewee played the martyr in a way. You know, she spoke to the university and let them know what was going on, but she also said, if I didn't live with her, someone else was going to have to. So she toughed it out for the rest of the year, although she went to a major, major state university. And the only way to get this roommate to remove the hamster was to institute a new university-wide rule, no pets, dead or alive.
Andrea from Astoria, hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi, Andrea.
Hi. Well, I also have a somewhat of a taxidermy story. I had just moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts in a large house with a bunch of people that I didn't know. And one of the gentlemen who lived there was a Harvard professor. He was very smart, great guy. One night, he had been driving home from the Cape, and a huge owl flew into his windshield. And he decided that, you know, it was such a beautiful animal, and he wanted to show it to his students as well as his children. So he decided to bring the owl home, put it in a plastic bag, not completely sealed, and stick it in our freezer with all of our food. So we woke up the next day and opened the freezer, and there was this feathered friend in the ice box. So, yeah, it was quite interesting. But we waited a couple of days. We all kind of agreed that we were going to ask him to remove it due to the germs that could have been on the animal.
To say the least.
Thank you for calling.
Yeah.
But you survived?
Of course. Yeah, we worked it out. But I've never been able to get that image out of my head of the feathers in the freezer.
And a listener on Twitter said that they had a flatmate who left wet towels against his window shade and eventually got really moldy and smelly. It probably could have led to some serious illnesses. A caller from New Jersey realized that his roommate only moved in with him because he wanted to avoid taxes by not having his own legal residence in New York. Space is sparse and expensive. Do a lot of conflicts arise out of the rush for housing because of financial necessity?
I think people certainly rush into roommate situations because they feel as if they don't have anywhere else to turn, and that can, of course, be a reason why you move in with someone without thinking about it too much. But surprisingly, you know, there are quite a few stories in the book that have, you know, I think the wet towels on the window is great, but there are shockingly amount of stories in the book where weird things grow in rooms, I have to say. There are, of course, moldy dishes, but in one example, the girl who I interviewed walked into her roommate's room because he was on vacation and there was a weird smell. She went in and lo and behold, pot plants growing in the apartment on the floor.
Emily on Twitter wrote, "My roommate would blame ghosts for her dirty dishes and refuse to clean them."
Dirty dishes are, again, universal. Yeah.
When I lived with the 8 girls, you could never tell whose dishes there were, so we had the balcony. We were in, like, the 9th floor, and they left their dishes out, and they left the windows open, and one day I come in, and there's just a seagull on top of the dishes, and then they stopped taking the trash out, and there were maggots on the trash sitting on the balcony.
In shows like Friends, a handful of roommates share one apartment, but the amenities are much more glamorous than in real life. Why is our pop culture so fixated on the premise of roommates and relationships?
You know, it's just ripe for crazy tales. There is no, you know, Friends, of course, is a fantastic example, but, you know, going back to the Golden Girls and even now with New Girl, the basic premise of each of these shows is kooky people move in with other kooky people and hilarity ensues. Mm-hmm. And
A lot of one-liners,
a lot of quippy tales, and of course, you know, situations that you think might only appear on TV at the hands of sitcom writers, but I think as the book shows, these things unfortunately can happen in real life too.
Now, we've heard a lot about how social media can sometimes promote false personae. And one of the stories, the impersonator, a roommate, is a victim of identity theft. When did she realize it?
You know, this was certainly one of the most extreme stories that I got. She did not realize it until she went to work one day and needed to photocopy her license, and it was not there. She realized, and this is a college student, very young, I think she was 18 at the time. Then she realized that the week before, her debit card had gone missing, and her boyfriend quickly informed her, "You need to look in your bank accounts. Something might have gone wrong." And when she did, she was $4,000 in the red.
And she hadn't suspected Serena at all?
She hadn't suspected a thing from her college roommate, who had been one of her closest friends the entire semester, had supported her after she found out that, you know, money was missing from her account, even accompanied her to the police station to give her account.
Colleges have online matching programs to promote happier living. Malia, do you think that students fill out the questionnaires honestly?
Well, I tried to, but probably not, especially if, you know, you're going to college and your mom is hovering over your shoulder and there are questions about your living. Of course, you're very neat. Tell them you're very neat. You want someone who's neat. And, yeah, I had my freshman year roommate, I filled out one of those surveys as well. But they matched you up, but then I looked at her profile, her MySpace profile, and her number one interest was Everclear.
In retrospect, what questions would you ask a prospective roommate on a survey?
I would rewrite the entire survey if I could now.
Take this alone, mm-hmm. You know.
And be honest.
In one story, Swedish neutrality, a group of unlikely athletes become close friends. One's Israeli, the other is a Palestinian Christian. And the person you spoke to was Swedish.
Yes.
I guess that was the neutral there. But it all worked.
It worked well. And you know, they had a common bond. There were 3 international students. They were all swimmers. And they'd all gone to the specific university in order to become athletes. And, you know, he had this great quote when I interviewed him. He said, "The thing about swimming is that you're stripped completely bare. It's just you and the water, and there's nothing to hide behind." And that was, according to the guy I interviewed, one of the reasons that they, you know, as teammates and as roommates, bonded so easily.
Let's take a call from Jan from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air, Jan.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I love your show. I had sort of a horror story with a freshman year roommate in college. Before I got to college, I got a letter in the mail from her on bunny rabbit stationery with matching bunny rabbit envelope that said she didn't approve of drinking, drugs, foul language, or racism, and she hoped that I would respect that. And within maybe the first week of being at college, she exhibited all 4 of those traits and continued to exhibit them throughout the year. She also became an anorexic who used to get up in the middle of the night to try my clothes on to make sure my clothes were too big for her. So that was my freshman year roommate horror story.
Wow. And you still decided to continue living with her?
I made it through the year. I had, again, a similar feeling like somebody has to live with her, so it might as well be me.
We've heard that a lot of times.
We have.
Grace, what was your reaction when the boys you were living with in that frat environment reenacted scenes from Cat on a Hot Tin Roof?
That was the experience I had when I lived with my cousin and his best friend, who had both studied musical theater in college, and so entertaining and around the clock. Nonstop music in my apartment, but because we were living sort of different lifestyles at the time and I was working different hours, that quiet time was so important to me, and hearing reenactments of what became one act plays were amazing stories, and one day I hoped I would be able to share them on a radio show. But at the time,
when the FCC allows it.
Yeah, of course. At the time when you're living there, it's your home and you want it to be quiet.
We don't have much more time, Stephanie, but a number of people have written in to talk about how they were supposed to split bills and it never happened. There are a lot of stiffing stories, aren't there?
Yes, there are.
Cable bills, rent,
yes,
whatever.
Yes, whether it's, you know, oh, I'm just going to round this bill, this utilities bill down, or whether it's, no, I will send you a check that bounces. You know, it's a common scenario, and unfortunately, as many of the people in my book can attest to, you don't always get the money back, even if you take them to small claims court.
Stephanie Wu is an editor at Town and Country, where she covers culture, food, and travel. She's also the founder and editor-in-chief of MochiMag.com, an online publication for young Asian American women. You were raised in Taipei. Do they have a lot of roommates there?
You know, Taipei is a big city just like New York, and I...
Well, okay. We got to leave it there. Thank you so much, all of you, for being on our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.